We all need to get around.
Addicted to oil.
Might as well face it, you're addicted
to oil.
Do you find yourself paying and paying for oil, sticking the needle in your tank? You need the stuff. You're addicted. Coming up on Radio EcoShock, the intervention for oil addicts. Special guest to find out why we're hooked. The Oil Addict Special, only on Radio EcoShock.
So when I compare oil and auto companies to tobacco companies, I don't do so lightly, because the chemical composition of what comes out of a tailpipe is remarkably similar to what comes out of a cigarette. And the harms are remarkably similar. And the corporate behavior that delivered those products and those harms and kept us addicted to them is remarkably similar.
That's Terry Tamminen, the green advisor to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The big question today, why can't we see our crazy dependency on fossil fuels? And why can't we kick the habit? I'm Alex Smith, and today we'll interview the author of an upcoming book on the globalization of addiction, Dr. Bruce Alexander from Simon Fraser University. I also have theories about addiction from Dr. Gabor Maté and from peak oil analyst Nate Higgins. Are we limited by our primitive brains? Just not smart enough to survive? California State Advisor Terry Tamminen wrote a whole book on the subject of oil addiction called Lives Per Gallon, and we'll hear a couple of quick clips from him. And I have some new quotes from Al Gore for you. But first, this important message. This program contains subject matter and language that may be disturbing to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
A and B present
Eco Intervention.
I always looked up to Gordon. I mean, we all thought he was a successful one. No one realized he was over his head.
One day, I'm thinking, who is this guy? Doesn't he care what will happen to his kids?
The addict in this program thinks he is in a documentary. He does not know. He is about to face an eco intervention.
The world just can't take it anymore. I can't. Taking out lace to fill up your tank? You think we don't know?
It's all out there now, Gordy. Everybody knows. You've got to have it, and it's not doing anyone any good. Time is up. It's running out, man. Quitting is the only way out.
When Eco Intervention returns, we sneak a peek at Gordy's garage. We'll continue with our oil intervention a little later, so just stay tuned for that. Our oil addiction is quite serious, though. You know our oil buys are funding overseas fossil fuel dealers that do not really love our culture. Some don't wish us well, but we pay them off anyway. Our economies at home and as a nation are being sucked dry by the need for oil. We just keep going into debt. And all the time, the exhaust fumes are poisoning us. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we'll find out exactly how smog kills with two top experts. But our most pressing problem, the really big challenge of all history, is the endless carbon dioxide we pump out into the atmosphere. If we can't kick this oil habit as a civilization, the life we love on planet Earth could be over for future humans. You know what I'm talking about. Almost everyone knows, and yet we still drive around uselessly in gas guzzlers and turn up the lights all night. Why? Why? Let's get to our interview with Bruce Alexander.
America is addicted to oil.
Even President George Bush admits we are addicted to oil, but what does that really mean? Dr. Bruce Alexander, a professor emeritus at Simon Fraser University in Canada, is a pioneer researching addiction. His ideas are so unconventional, he won the Sterling Prize for Controversy. Bruce Alexander is currently writing a book titled The Globalization of Addiction, A Study in the Poverty of the Spirit. Today we're going to pick Dr. Alexander's brain on the addiction that could change our climate virtually forever, fossil fuels. And to do that, we'll have to ask first, Bruce, what is addiction?
Addiction is, in a word, addiction is overwhelming involvement. That is, being so wrapped up in something or some things that all the rest of the things which make a normal, satisfying, socially productive life diminish in appearance, in importance.
Well, what are some of the leading addictions, then, in the world today?
Of course, naturally, we think first of drug and alcohol addiction, but they are not the most common of addictions. We did some research up at Simon Fraser. For students, the most common of addictions are serious overwork and sports, physical activity, particularly dancing for girls, dysfunctional love relationships, and again, particularly for women, eating disorders, that is to say, addiction to starvation, anorexia, or bulimia.
So it doesn't mean that you have to be a poor person down in the streets with a needle in your arm to be addicted. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think we have used those poor people with the needles in their arms as kind of examples or better as scapegoats, because addiction is a much, much larger problem than needle addiction in the downtown east side.
Well, how do we determine what's the difference between someone's, I mean, you mentioned dancing, for example, what's the difference between someone's leading passion in life and that passion overtaking their life and damaging their other relationships or something?
Well, it's the difference between being able to walk when you're 40 or not. I mean, some people give up their hope for growing up with normal knees in order to do just to sacrifice everything to succeed in their dancing, for example. And not only do they give up their body, but they give up their friendships, they give up everything. They just do whatever is necessary in order to succeed at this one consuming passion. And in the end, they don't feel very good about it. In the end, there isn't much left. On the other hand, some people love to dance and dance, you know, with all the passion that you can imagine. But they have a life as well, and they make their life relate to their dancing. And so when they're done, when their career as dancers are over, they move on to something else. They haven't spent themselves.
You know, this makes me interested, too. There's a fellow named Nate Hagans. He's completing his PhD at the University of Vermont, and he speaks at a peak oil conference, really. And he's, prior to taking his PhD, he worked with people who invested tens and hundreds, well, in fact, only hundreds of millions of dollars. And he thought that, well, after they've made $100 million, they might want to stop. But no, now they've got to make double that. So something like even investment banking could be an addiction.
Oh, sure it could. There's a really good series of studies on billionaires. And, of course, not all billionaires are addicted, but many are. And many are people who are just, you know, consumed, just in the way I was talking about a dancer who's addicted. They are consumed with making money, gaining power, and all the rest. And these stories are brutal. I mean, they're hard to read. They're so sad, both for the billionaire himself and for the children of these people who suffer immensely.
Well, let's move over towards oil, if we could, because the thing is that we're learning now that the oil is perhaps poisonous in the air, that it's damaging our lungs from these cars and even our kids' lungs. We know that we might die in a car accident just trying to get to work, and now we're finding out that we may wreck the climate forever, and yet there we go, you and me, off to the gas pumps and stick that needle in the car's arm, if you will. Is it possible that oil is as addictive as heroin?
Yes, but I wouldn't put it that way.
Okay.
I agree with everything you've said. I think the addiction is to affluence. For example, if our cars suddenly were not run on oil but were run on firewood, we'd continue doing what we're doing. It's not the oil per se. What we're addicted to is, generally speaking, what people are addicted to is an affluent lifestyle, and I think that is really perhaps the fatal flaw of our culture. And I think that this addiction to affluence, which of course includes consuming oil, is understandable in exactly the same terms as every other kind of addiction. If we go back to sort of the prototypical addiction of the guy with the needle in his arm in downtown East Side, Well, that guy, why is he doing that? It isn't because he loves heroin all that much. It's because he hasn't got a life. It's because, you know, whatever has happened in the past, this guy has really got nothing to live for, except he finds some kind of a identity and some kind of relief in the needle habit and in the society of junkies and the downtown East time, downtown East Side. There's a whole pattern of rewards that go along with being a junkie, and they and those rewards are absolutely essential for a person who hasn't got any other life. Well, at the other end of the spectrum, there's an awful lot of people who really don't have a life, who are not on the downtown East Side. And these are people who grow up in areas where, you know, they have no real community, they have no real prospects of work that would be meaningful to them, they have no sense of religion, they have no sense of ethics or caring for others in their society. They are really abandoned people, and for them, the heroin quite often is affluence. It's having a, you know, big house and having three cars in the garage, and, you know, being able to drive all over the place, go wherever you want, whenever you want to. It has this incredible sense of freedom, and of course, going with a good, powerful car, so you feel safe and a little bit superior to the people with the meager little cars next to you. Well, the pattern is the same, and my work as a psychologist really is very rewarding in that sense, because I spent a lot of time in the downtown East Side. I've talked an awful lot to people who stick needles in their arms, and I have talked an awful lot to people who live in much more affluent areas and who, as far as I can tell, suffer from exactly the same deprivation and compensate for it with exactly the same kinds of addictions, although in one case it's drugs and in the other case it's affluence, which includes oil.
Well, I was also interested in your early research where, if I may summarize, you found that rats in very small little cages, sure, you can get them addicted to heroin, but if you give them a really nice big cage with a proper environment that a mammal could enjoy, then they're less likely to become addicted. And then I started thinking about ourselves in our little boxes. We're at home watching TV or in offices or cars. Is it possible that we're just as displaced as those rats were?
Yeah, it is possible. And that's why I've entitled my forthcoming book, The Globalization of Addiction. Because if you look at what's being globalized, it really is a society where everything is sacrificed to the needs of the market, to, you know, maintaining the economy and keeping the wheels turning. And in that kind of a way, that's very much like being tied up in a little cage, because people really don't have much opportunity to do much that has any importance to them. They're really isolated. Now, of course, this is not true of every single human being on Earth, but I think this trend is very visible everywhere on Earth. For example, you know, if you want to look at the two areas where addiction has increased most conspicuously in the last 30 years or so, and you could guess, it's sort of an interesting thing to guess at, but the answer is England under Margaret Thatcher, that is the UK under Margaret Thatcher, and China under Deng Xiaoping. Now, why those two areas? Not that addiction hasn't increased in other places, but it's just gone like wildfire in those two areas in the last few decades. Why there? Well, perhaps there because those are the areas where the influence of the market economy has been accelerating at the most frantic, absolutely astounding kind of rate.
Well, we're talking over the problem of oil addiction with Simon Fraser University Professor Emeritus Bruce Alexander. Bruce, everyone likes to laugh about the hippies going back to the land, but I wonder if those people are seeking a more natural environment where their addictions to things like television and shopping and lottery tickets can subside. Could that be part of the answer, making our living arrangement more suitable for the mammals that we really are?
Well, I think so. I think we have to find a way to do that. And, of course, it's a lot more difficult than perhaps it seemed to people in the 1960s. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. I think we can construct a society in which people's needs are taken care of. And by that, of course, I mean beyond their physical needs and their needs for a fast car. I mean their needs, their psychological needs. I think what's happening in this particular time in history is that we're coming to recognize that people's psychological needs are absolutely central, that people are not satisfied with what markets can give them alone. We could say man does not live by bread alone. We've come to know that, and certainly it's possible to reconstruct society in a way that maintains its modern technological virtues, but also makes it possible for us to supply our real needs as human beings.
Do you have some ideas on how we could apply what you've discovered about the myths and the realities of addiction to kick this fossil fuel habit before it kills us?
Well, I don't think we're going to kick the fossil fuel habit separately from kicking all the other addictive habits. I mean, it would be nice if we could just, in our wisdom, say, well, okay, we've got to stop consuming so much fossil fuel, and I wish we could do that. But I think the fact that we act so irrationally about oil, so totally irrationally, makes it evident that it's not just a rational problem. It's a psychological problem. I think we have to solve the psychological problem. And when we solve the psychological problem, we will solve the oil problem, but we'll also solve the drug problem. And we'll also solve the starvation problem.
And are we getting any closer to understanding, say, the way the brain works or the chemicals work? Is that part of the direction that might solve this problem?
Well, there's a lot of really excellent biochemical research, which is going on, neurochemical research, which is going on at this point. And so far, I don't think the big insights are coming from neurochemical research. I think the big insights are coming from historians, anthropologists, and sociologists who are, you know, discovering what people have to have in order to live without addiction. I think, however, that neurochemical research will inevitably play a part in whatever kind of psychological gains that we make, but at the present, it's not the neurochemical research that's leading the way.
And am I right to think from the title of your book, The Globalization of Addiction, that as more and more of the world becomes developed and hooked into the central system, that addiction, instead of fading away as a social problem, will actually just keep increasing?
Oh, yeah. It's increasing steadily, like, as we speak. And we have to, there has to be a point where that curve stops going up, because it can't go up forever. It's exactly like global warming. You know, you look at the curves and you realize those curves have got to go down. But they aren't going down yet for addiction, and they aren't going down yet for global warming either. I mean, my prediction is that they'll start going down at the same time, because they are manifestations of the same underlying problem. That is to say, the same commitment to hyper-capitalism, if we could call it that, or a sort of ultra-free market society, gives us global warming, but it also gives us the kind of human alienation that leads to addiction. So I think we're going to solve them at the same time. And God willing, we're going to solve them.
Well, I don't know if I'm really encouraged yet. It sounds like we've still got a ways to go as far as addiction goes, and of course it causes a lot of heartache in a lot of people's lives. It just seems so intractable to me. We have this rational mind that can look into the future, and yet it seems our psychology leads us to just, well, I'm going to deal with today, and so if it costs me $110 to fill up my tank, and I'm just going to go ahead and keep driving this SUV. Somehow, it seems, as an environmentalist, I feel, we've got to find some tools to reach our own brains, yours and mine, to stop that before we cloud up the whole atmosphere of the planet.
Well, my faith comes from looking at the history of social change in the past. Particularly recently, I've been looking at the history of the anti-slavery movement in England in the early part of the 19th century, where, you know, slavery had been going on for forever, essentially. And then over the period of about 30 years, people became so enraged and so determined to put slavery to an end that they did. At one point, 300,000 people in England boycotted sugar because it was produced by slaves. And that, along with a whole bunch of other things that they did and that the slaves themselves did in you know, trying to overthrow this system, overthrew it. And so industrial slavery came to an end in that century, all within the course of really a few decades. And I think that that's where we are now. We're at the sort of the culmination of a very, very bad system of whatever you want to call it. Let's call it globalization. We're at the culmination of centuries of globalization. And we can see now in all kinds of ways that system is killing us. We've got to bring it to an end. And tons of people, are getting involved with it in all kinds of organizations. There's a recent book by a man named Paul Hawken, who makes the argument that there's probably about a million grassroots organizations on Earth right now who are devoted to this problem that we're talking about. Well, I think we are in an era where things can change and things have to change, and therefore things will change. That's where my hope comes from.
Well, I appreciate your hope, and I could see the sort of darkest before the dawn argument. Certainly, most of us do feel that a massive change is required if we're going to keep on living a worthwhile life and if we're going to preserve our climate. Is there anything else you'd like to offer for us?
No, I think that covers it. I hope you'll mention that my book is coming out in September.
I was going to ask you about that. Who's publishing it?
It's published by the Oxford University Press in UK. It'll be released in England first, and then it'll be out here in September.
Okay, so that's The Globalization of Addiction, A Study in the Poverty of Spirit by Dr. Bruce Alexander. Thanks so much for taking the time for working this over with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Eco Intervention.
Gordon looks just like a normal guy. He commutes an hour each way every day to support his family. Or is he just supporting his habit? While Gordon is inside glued to the TV watching his favorite NASCAR race, we will take a tour of his garage, his crib, with worried wife, Annette. Annette, you have a big two-car garage, and yet your little car is parked out here on the driveway. Can you show us what is inside?
Sure, come in. But this isn't really my territory. This is Gordy's collection, and he loves this stuff as much as he loves me. I'm sure of it. That's his truck there.
Gordon has a brand new one-ton pickup truck. All tricked out, it's easy to tell there's a big V8 under the hood.
It's a four-wheel drive, but Gordy doesn't go anywhere out of town. He's in it every day, going to work, and out in the evenings, visiting friends, looking for cheap gas wherever he can find it. He fills up at least twice a week at $100 a pop. Since our mortgage went up, he's putting it all on Visa. He thinks I don't know, but I found the bill. We just can't afford his oil habit anymore, but Gordy can't see that. He's hooked.
This other car, is it a racing car?
That's his hot rod. He's had it since high school, like it's holy or something.
As we look around, I can see all kinds of gasoline-powered machinery. Gordon has a snowmobile, an off-road motorcycle, and look here, the whole collection of power yard tools.
He loves to ride on that mower, and we can't get him to put the leaf blower down. Gordon used to rake the leaves. Now he hangs out in the yard, blasting every last leaf. I think he's trying to look busy, so he doesn't have to help me with the housework. I hardly see him without an engine running.
Stay tuned. When we come back, Gordon will take us for a ride as we follow his need for oil.
Might as well face it, we're addicted to oil. My lights are on, but not for long. My car needs more than corn. My house is cold, no natural gas. So I just sit and freeze my ass. No barbecue, can't cut the grass. Long showers, a thing of the past. The price of oil is so obscene. The best perfumes, now gasoline. Whoa, I used to think I could cut down on the stuff. Oh yeah. Now they come and tell us that we can't get enough. And then Bush goes and says that we're addicted to oil. We saw the signs in 73, back when we had to reduce speed. It's getting worse, we do time. To get to fart, you stand in line, a big long line, and you're in pain. But there's no farting unless it's retained. The slogan is, the signs say, if you've got gas, you drive today. Whoa, whoa, I used to think we could consume just enough. Oh, yeah. But OPEC's figured out that we're hooked on the stuff. You know you're gonna have to face it, we're addicted to oil. Might as well face it, we're addicted to oil. In the winters I'll freeze, in the summers I'll boil. I can't fill up my car without getting screwed royal. Cause the price is sky high and I'm addicted to oil.
Addicted to Oil was written and performed by Luce Bruce Kerr. Bruce is a lawyer for Sun Microsystems, and he tells me a video for this song is in the works.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
But then we ask ourselves, as a society, don't we have so many behaviors that are negative for us, that in fact are harmful to us as individuals, harmful to the society, harmful to the earth, and yet we persist?
Addiction is a deep and dangerous problem in all the westernized world. Both Bruce Alexander, our first guest, and the deep green ecologist Derek Jensen suggest that humans have been removed from the biological surroundings where we evolved. Our hardwired need to hear wild things, to judge weather by the distant clouds and the wind, to smell danger, are all sidelined now. They are replaced by video games, TV, tall buildings, and these little boxes of rolling steel we call our cars. Here is a quick quote from the recent speech by Dr. Gabor Maté of Vancouver.
For a moment, I'll go beyond drug addiction because it's my contention, and not only my contention, but also really what science shows, is that there's an addiction process. There's only one addiction process, and that addiction process affects and transcends any particular target, because the brain circuits of addiction are the same, whether it's power or status or sex or shopping, or gambling, or alcohol, or cocaine, or whatever it is you happen to be addicted to. Cocaine, or whatever it is you happen to be addicted to.
Eco-intervention.
Gordon and Annette have been fighting over Gordon's addiction to oil. Although they live near a mass transit line, Gordon has never used it. He drives 3 blocks to the convenience store just for a soft drink. Gordon's growing weight is worrying his family.
Let's face it, transit stinks. It's for losers. People are on my case about my truck, but then they always like to ride along. It's big, and I like it that way. Then, when I get home, there's all this yard work, so yeah, I need some power tools.
How long have you been living this way?
That's the way everybody lives. We've always used oil. Maybe I use more than most, but that's just me. I buy the stuff at Cost at Walmart. And there's plenty of places in town you can get gas, wherever you need it. Just look around this town. Everybody's doing gas, not just me.
Coming up next, Gordon thinks he's going to help his friend Norman fix his car. He doesn't know his family is waiting to beg him to change.
Is the Philippines, the United States uses 38 times the energy as the Philippines, yet roughly the same happiness. All this stuff doesn't make us happier.
We wonder why people in society are not motivated by the dangers we face. Why did it take so long to accept climate change? Why are the majority still in denial about the limited amount of oil on this planet? And why can't we act when our rational minds know a clear and present danger? Nate Hagans presented a theory about our blindness and denial in a most unusual place. Hagans was a vice president at the investment firm Salmon Brothers and Lehman Brothers. His clients needed to have at least $50 million to get his advice. Then he returned to the university world. He now investigates the coming decline of oil and gas and what new solutions might work. Hagans is also an editor of a peak oil energy-oriented blog called theoildrum.com. It's quite popular, gets a lot of hits, theoildrum.com. I'm going to run you part of the speech Nate Hagans gave to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, or ASPO, held in Cork, Ireland, in mid-September 2007. The talk was called A Framework for Supply and Demand on a Full Planet. If you dig around on the net, you can still find the full video of the speech. Here is Nate Hagans.
Now on to the fun and what I think more interesting things. In order to know where we're headed, we have to know where we've come from. And human behavior can only properly be viewed as a product of natural selection. This is not a radical pronunciation anymore. This has been completely proven in the last few years by cognitive neuroscience and other fields, and they're essentially completely disproven the rational actor model of neoclassical economics. Our so-called rational mind does simply not have that much control over the rest of our mind and our bodies, and I'm going to talk about that for the rest of my talk. Yesterday's honest and wise speaker a long time ago said that we only have two modes when it comes to energy, complacency and panic. I'm going to explain the evolutionary origins of that comment. Our current president has also said America is addicted to oil. I think what he meant was that we're addicted to the energy services that oil provides, and I'm going to talk about that as well. Next spring, I'm organizing a conference in California that's going to be a lateral thinking conference. It's trying to get a lot of different, there's too many academic disciplines right now, and they're so splintered, and we need to start talking to each other more because there's just not enough time and there's too much going on. Now, when I give this speech to undergraduates, I usually lunge at the front row to give this impact, but the former director of the CIA is there, so I figured I'd err on the safe side. But if you were paying attention to this, maybe you know that you're in this warm room and you just had some coffee and everything is safe, but you might have had a physical reaction of some norepinephrine or your fight-or-flight impulse. That has nothing to do with what I'm saying or what your conscious mind is thinking. It's a physical response. We share systems that have evolved for millions and millions of years within us that are part of us. If you look at the first human life was about 3 billion years ago, the brain since then has never slept. It's added on pieces and pieces. The first brain was something that moved away from a stimulus or moved towards the light. And basically, reptiles and dinosaurs, 65 million years ago, there was a meteor, the Chicxulub meteor, wiped out 90% of the Earth, mammals at that point, and we've all come from that point. But the reptilian brain was built on top of the primitive, the simple brain, and the mammalian brain, which is also called the limbic system or emotional system, was built on top of that. Many millions of generations. Even at 20 years per human generation, since we split off from apes, that's 250,000 generations where our neocortex or our new mammalian brain expanded, and it expanded because the brain is a physical system; it functions as a computer, and it was designed to solve the problems of what our ancestral environment was, which is very different than the problems of today. So if you look in the lower right, that is the different regions of our brain, the reptilian brain, as I was saying, the limbic system, and then the neocortex, which separates us from the lower animals. It's important to point out that Homo sapiens evolved amidst scarcity. The gentleman that gave me this graph is actually on my thesis committee. He wrote a book called American Mania, and he runs UCLA's Neuroscience Institute. So if we talk about you know, this is Aspel 6, and there were things in the 70s that people talked about. Unless we have a smoking gun like DDT or unleaded gas or chlorofluorocarbon, something like that, we need a smoking gun. Otherwise, we don't react until there is a critical stimulus. If you think about it, for millions of years of evolution, why would there have been a selection pressure for something to defer consumption? If a cheetah or one of a previous hominids decided, no, I think I'll kill that animal next week, he would have been outcompeted by, you know, his peer group. So we have a deep history of favoring the present over the future. And frankly, the only reasons that humans don't completely favor the present over the future is because we have built infrastructure. We have sunk costs in our built capital. And this can be measured by something called the discount rate. Everyone think for a moment, would you prefer a 15-minute massage right now or a 20-minute massage 2 hours from now? Neuroeconomists and psychologists call this a small short-term reward versus a large long-term reward. Most of us would just say, well, 15 minutes right now, I'll take it right now. I don't want to wait 2 hours for an extra 5 minutes. But next week, I'll arrange my schedule so that I'll get the extra 5 minutes. So we can actually measure these decisions by what's called a discount rate. A discount rate is used in finance, but it also could be used in economics, where a discount rate of 1 means we value the present completely. A discount rate of 0 means we value something in 2050 the same as we do today. So something very fascinating has been working on the last few years, where people have discovered via brain scans and neuroeconomics that our two areas of brains that I talked about before, the neomammalian limbic system and our rational human thinking system, discount the future at completely different rates. When we make emotional decisions, we highly value the present over the future. And the rational brain is when we're figuring out mortgage payments or Hubbard linearization is more precise, but our emotional brains are focused on the present. So it ends up leading into dynamic inconsistency. A lot of us have probably had these promises where we know that we need to do something, and we decide today to do it, but we decide to do it in the future. But very quickly, tomorrow becomes today, and our plans are hijacked. So basically, our rational minds, we plan to make the right choice, but our emotional brains are stronger. As I said before, we're not really addicted to oil, but we're addicted to some of the energy services it provides. Shoppers, for example, you get the most pleasure at the moment you decide to buy that pair of shoes. And after that, there's a slow decay until 2 or 3 weeks after. It's like, oh, these shoes, I've worn them already, you know, no big deal. Sex, it's not that big of a leap for someone, a man, to see a picture of a woman in a bikini, and 5 years later he's a subscriber to pygmytransvestiteorgy.com or something like that. We easily get hijacked by things that our brain doesn't know are bad for us. Just this morning I read about a man in China who played a video game on a computer for 48 hours and he died. So that can happen. 19 million addicted to alcohol, illegal drugs, nicotine. 80 to 90% of adults routinely ingest caffeine. Caffeine steepens our discount rates. When we have caffeine in our system, we're more likely to make a short-term response. Why is that legal? I don't know. Note that the USA only has 300 million people, so certainly some of these have been double counted. So dopamine is a wanting drug. It doesn't make us feel like we're satisfied. We cannot get enough. As soon as you have some, you want more. A classic story, this is a brain scan of a normal person and someone with Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's is one area of the brain that does not have enough dopamine. And so there's a drug called Mirapex where they give to the Parkinson's patients. Well, dozens of Parkinson's patients in the last 2 years have checked into the Mayo Clinic with bizarre behavioral problems. They have a church pastor had 6 extramarital affairs. A guy who'd never gambled in his life lost $100,000 at an Indian casino. So too much dopamine actually caused these people to have behavior in other areas of their brain. You know, it's not just simple as one chemical, but it's a big deal. And as you can see, this is the day after Thanksgiving, and shopping begins to look like an addiction. So in the broad picture of things, a long time ago, we didn't have as much access to novelty. We would have a great meal, and that would be like our stimulation, and then we'd go with our work for the day. More recently, a visit from a singer or a traveling bard or a relative might have given us that boost. But now we've got so much novelty, Disneyland, Irish dancers, rave clubs, etc. There's just so much that our unexpected rewards, keep increasing. So a couple points I want to make. This novelty, think of a volume knob on your stereo. If you listen to music at a 2 and you turn it up to an 8 for a week, you can't really go back to a 2 again. It's not the same. So it's just kind of a one-way track. And we've won the energy lottery in a broad sense as a species. But if you look at research, psychological research on lottery winners, they have 10 times the suicide rate as non-lottery winners, huge depression rates. Lottery winners get a quick burst of happiness, but then they quickly recede.
That was Nate Hagens, an editor at theoildrum.com, an investment expert and a researcher into energy and alternative energy. He was speaking at the ASPO 6 Peak Oil and Gas Conference in Ireland, September 2007.
Eco Intervention.
Gordon Wilson lives in suburbia. On the outside, his 6,000-square-foot house looks quite normal in this neighborhood. But hidden in the backyard is a 4,000-watt patio heater, a giant gas barbecue, and yet another V8 truck. And back in his palatial storage shed, Gordon has 21,000 Christmas tree lights waiting for the annual contest with his neighbors. Tonight, the whole yard is lit up as bright as day. All the lights in the house are on, too, as we await Gordon's arrival. We have his sister Ginny on the speakerphone. Wife Annette and his best buddy Norman are nervously waiting. As a counselor, I'll try to help the family to steer Gordon toward the treatment he needs. Gordon is coming in now.
Hello, love.
Hi there.
What is going on here? Is this some kind of trick?
Gordon, your friend and family are here to help you. They want you to quit using oil. You need to withdraw as quickly as possible. Your sister Ginny is on the speakerphone. She will start.
Gordon, I would have flown out there for this, but that would just add tons more carbon dioxide to the problem. You don't understand that, I know, but I have kids to think about. What will their climate be like, Gordy? Do you ever think about that? My little girl has asthma. I can't have her around you, Gordon. She'd choke on your exhaust. Do you care about that? Do you even know when you leave your engine running? You're my brother, but I can't be around you. I just can't breathe when I'm around you. I want the old Gordy, the brother that had fun walking or riding a bike. Well, what happened? You need to go for treatment, Gordon. Nobody can stand what is happening now.
Come on, this is crap. You all like my new truck. Everybody wanted a ride. Anyway, I need to get to work, so just leave me alone.
Gordon, you know I promised for better or for worse, but we just can't afford to go into debt, to keep paying off people we don't know. You could sell all that stuff and we'll pay off the bills. I know about the late night visits to the pump, you cruising around town for the best prices. You're only fooling yourself. Gordon, we have to think about our future. You've changed. You just drive around and then sit in front of the TV. And I can't stand all the noise. Gordon, we've arranged a place for you to go, to get away from the temptation of oil. I'm begging you, get off oil. It's just no good for you. No good for any of us.
Gordon, your family has arranged a visit to a solar-powered facility. There is an electric car waiting outside right now to take you to an eco-village.
An electric car? Some stupid little car. What will the neighbors think?
Gordon, it goes from 0 to 80 in less than 4 seconds.
Well, that sounds all right. Maybe I could. Can I drive?
Maybe after a while, Gordon. First, you need to get used to transit. You'll learn to install a solar panel and use low-powered LED lights. At night, it will be dark outside.
I can't. I love all my stuff. It's part of who I am.
Gordy, you know we go way back to high school. The oil is running out, buddy. The price is just going to keep going up, draining you, draining your family. All your money just goes to the oil gangs. And the climate is going nuts. You know that, Gordon. The floods, the fires last summer.
I know. I know it in my heart. It's just so hard to give it up. Something you've had. Whenever I get down.
Will you go now, Gordon? Are you ready to give up oil?
I'll give it a try. Okay. Let's go.
I love you, Gordy.
Good for you, Gordy. Bye.
Come back clean, buddy.
Gordon went to Eco Village for 90 days. He came back fit and tanned. Gordon sold all his vehicles. He bikes and uses transit, but he's still afraid he'll go back to oil. It has been 6 months since his last visit to the pumps. Gordon is clean for now. If you know someone who is addicted to oil, arrange an eco intervention before it's too late and send them to ecoshock.org. Ecovention was written by Alex Smith. Gordy the Oil Addict was played by the up-and-coming Canadian actor Matt Codrington. His buddy Norman was none other than The Stimulator, creator of the wildly popular video podcast The End of the World as We Know It. Find that at submedia.tv. Sister Ginny was an anonymous radio personality, and wife Annette was really Canadian journalist Colleen Kimmett. I liked Colleen's work in the online journal The Tyee, and we hope to have some of her science and tech reporting on Radio EcoShock. You can download Ecovention as a complete radio playlist from our website at ecoshock.org. I'm not going to end this show with the total failure of our species. The rational mind does seem to dominate in a few places. Here is one hopeful development related by Tim Flannery from his recent speech in Toronto, Canada. On April 4th, 2008, Tim Flannery, the author of The Weathermakers, was speaking in Toronto, Canada. Here is just a little clip from that speech where he describes the way electric cars will be installed in Denmark to replace oil-based transport.
I was in Denmark last week. I chair something called the Copenhagen Climate Council. It includes a group of businesses from East Asia, including Communist China. We have major energy generators on our council, as well as European generators and some American companies, and we're all pledged to keep the level of greenhouse gas pollution below the dangerous threshold. Last week, a big wind energy company in Denmark called Dong Energy announced a partnership with an Israeli-US company called Better Place. It was the most innovative and exciting announcement because what they said they were going to do was basically shift Denmark's transport, private transport, motor vehicle transport, from a fossil fuel base to a sustainable base. Dong Energy announced that they were going to electrify one out of every six parking spaces in Denmark by the end of 2009. That is hundreds of millions of euros worth of investment just there. They were also going to roll out battery exchange stations across the country. Better Place, for its part, had developed a whole lot of really smart technology around electric cars, and they've gone into partnership with car manufacturers to produce these really sexy and really fast electric cars. They're great things. They're things that anyone would be very, very happy to drive, particularly if you like speed and acceleration. The torque on these things is fantastic. But the idea is that you'll top up your car with juice, just a bit like you top up your mobile phone. You pull into an electrified place, plug in. The grid will recognise who you are, charge you for the amount of electricity you use, and you'll drive off. When you go to a battery exchange, the battery just lifts straight out of the back of these cars. You put another one in, it'll take you less time than it does to fuel up with gasoline. This is really happening. I mean, this by 2010, this is going to be a significant part of the Danish system. The government, we had the Vice Prime Minister there, who announced a tax holiday on electric cars until 2012. which is significant in Denmark because tax on motor vehicles there is 180%. So this is an amazing program. Why would Dong Energy, a wind company, be part of this, you might think? The reason is that overnight they generate a lot of electricity with their wind turbines, but they don't have a market for that electricity. At the moment, it goes to waste because no one's drawing the electricity down. They figure that if they can be charging car batteries with that electricity, they will have found a market for a product, a valuable product they don't have a market for at present. I never thought I'd see the day, you know, when wind turbines would be driving the oil people out of business. But that's what we're starting to see. Incredibly exciting time to be around. Those sort of initiatives that where you see crossover technologies and new partnerships, I think are just going to become very, very important in future.
Tim Flannery is the author of the best-selling climate book, The Weathermakers, and you can download his new speech from the Radio EcoShock website at ecoshock.org. My thanks to John Paul Warren of Toronto, who recorded that speech, to share it with us all. Terry Tamminen, author of the book Lives Per Gallon, also thinks we can make it off oil.
We can do this. We have enough renewable resources not only to kick our petroleum habit, but to kick our greenhouse gas habit. People say to me, well, come on, Terry, look, we're always going to be somewhat beholden to fossil fuels. We can use less. Let's have a hybrid. Let's have a plug-in hybrid. Let's get 100 miles a gallon. And my answer is no. Would you tell a heroin addict that if he just uses half as much, he's going to be okay? I don't think so. And the same thing is true here. We've got to kick this addiction 100%. There's enough sunlight that falls on the earth in an hour to power all human energy needs for a year. There's more than enough biomass out here and tidal power and wave power, sun power, wind power to power all of your needs and, in fact, to power a lot of our needs in California. And throughout the country, we can take these renewable resources, whether it's agricultural waste or urban green waste or other biomass or wind or solar, and we can absolutely convert our entire electric and transportation energy system to run on renewables.
Let's hear some new clips from Al Gore speaking in April 2007 at TED.
The developing countries are now following us and accelerating their pace. And actually, their cumulative emissions this year are the equivalent of where we were in 1965, and they're catching up very dramatically. The total concentrations by 2025, they will be essentially where we were in 1985. NBC, I'll show all of the networks here, the top journalists for NBC asked 956 questions in 2007 of the presidential candidates. Two of them were about the climate crisis. ABC, 844 questions, two about the climate crisis. Fox, two. CNN, two. CBS, zero. The North Polar ice cap is the same size geographically. It doesn't look that quite the same size, but it is exactly the same size as the United States minus an area roughly equal to the state of Arizona. The amount that disappeared in 2005 was equivalent to everything east of the Mississippi. We can't wait for the kind of drought Australia had to change our political culture. We can do this. Don't tell me that we don't have the capacity to do it. If we had just 1 week's worth of what we spend on the Iraq war, we could be well on the way to solving this challenge. We have the capacity to do it. If you are investing in tar sands or shale oil, then you have a portfolio that is crammed with subprime carbon assets. And it is based on an old model. Junkies find veins in their toes when the ones in their arms and their legs collapse. Developing tar sands and coal shale is the equivalent. And we have to find a way to create in the generation of those alive today a sense of generational mission. I wish I could find the words to convey this. I'm optimistic because I believe we have the capacity at moments of great challenge to set aside the causes of distraction and rise to the challenge that history is presenting to us.
This collection of new Al Gore clips comes from a speech in April 2007 given at TED, the Technology, Entertainment, and Design folks. Find more of their free videos on the web at TED.com. Our background music was from the Cyber Zen Sound Engine, and you can find this little collection of clips at ecoshock.org.
This challenge is part of the fabric of our whole civilization. CO2 is the exhaling breath of our civilization, literally. And now we've mechanized that process. Changing that pattern requires a scope, a scale, a speed of change that is beyond what we have done in the past. So that's why I began by saying, be optimistic in what you do, but be an active citizen. Demand, change the light bulbs, but change the laws. Change the global treaties. We have to speak up. We have to solve this democracy. We have sclerosis in our democracy, and we have to change that. Use the internet. Go on the internet. Connect with people. Become very active as citizens. Have a moratorium. We shouldn't have any new coal-fired generating plants that aren't able to capture and store CO2, which means we have to quickly build these renewable sources. Now, nobody is talking on that scale, but I do believe that between now and November, it is possible. This Alliance for Climate Protection is going to launch a nationwide campaign, grassroots mobilization, television ads, internet ads, radio, newspaper, with partnerships with everybody from the Girl Scouts to the hunters and fishermen. We need help. We need help.
Next week on Radio EcoShock, we'll investigate breaking news that tens of thousands of people in North America and in Europe are dying prematurely, simply due to unseen poisons in vehicle emissions. Nobody wants to talk about this one, but your doctor and your government know. Smog kills. I'm Alex Smith, and thanks for tuning in this week. My address is radio@ecoshock.org, and check out our free audio downloads at ecoshock.org.
Might as well face it, we're addicted to oil. My lights are on, but not for long. My car eats more than corn. My house is cold, no natural gas, so I just sit and freeze my ass. No barbecue, can't cut the grass. Long showers, a thing of the past. The price of oil is so obscene. The best perfumes, now gasoline. Whoa, I used to think I could cut down on the stuff. Oh yeah. Now they come and tell us that we can't get enough. And then Bush goes and says that we're addicted to oil. We saw the signs in 73, back when we had to reduce speed. Keeps getting worse in due time. To get to fart, you stand in line, a big long line, and you're in pain. But there's no farting unless it's retained. The slogan is, the signs say, if you've got gas, you drive today. Whoa, whoa, I used to think we could consume just enough. Oh, yeah. But OPEC's figured out that we're hooked on the stuff. You know you're gonna have to face it, we're addicted to oil. Might as well face it, we're addicted to oil. In the winters I'll freeze, in the summers I'll boil. I can't fill up my car without getting screwed royal. Cause the price is sky high and I'm addicted to oil.